The horrific scenes of the mob lynching of Pehlu Khan, a 50-year-old dairy farmer from Rajasthan, just north of New Delhi, caught on camera and uploaded to the internet by those accused of murdering him. His six attackers were filmed beating him to death whilst he pleaded for mercy. Last week, they were acquitted of murder on a technicality. The video had apparently not met the standards of forensic evidence. This was despite countless witnesses, two of whom were his sons, also beaten, and despite one of the assailants admitting to the murder to an undercover reporter. Around 50 have been lynched in the last 3 years alone by the so-called cow vigilantes, and hundreds have been injured. This is the state of India, home to 200 million Muslims, some 14% of the population. This is Muhammad Jalal, and this week I'm going to speak to Fazal Hijazi, an Indian-based academic in Islamic sciences currently pursuing his doctoral studies in the energy economies of the Arab world. Fazal has extensively travelled across India, and he is also a regular visitor to Kashmir. In this second part podcast, more than 2 weeks since the Indian government's actions in Kashmir, I want to explore the doctrine that underpins Modi's India, known as Hindutva, and its impact upon the country's Muslims. It is oft forgotten that after partition in 1947, Pakistan became home to just a portion of India's Muslims. Those that were left behind have been subject to state and structural disadvantage, never more so than under the Hindu nationalism of Modi's tenure. Indian politics has since partition been dominated by the Congress Party, the party of its founder Nehru. This one-party domination collapsed in 1998 for a brief period when the Hindu nationalist BJP came to office, and it seemed, for a while at least, that the new two-party system would replace the monopoly of Congress. When the BJP lost power in 2004 and Congress returned to dominate Indian politics for a decade, such views seemed premature. However, in 2014, under Narendra Modi, the BJP returned and today dominates the Indian political landscape, winning a landslide victory in April. This is in no small part down to both the Obama and Trump administrations barely hiding their support for Modi. For the Americans, the BJP government is ready to side with it in order to encircle its new opponent, China. This is why, despite his obvious power grab in Kashmir, Modi is feted around the world, moving from the UAE to the G7 summit in France, posing with the so-called great powers. Not only does this embolden Modi at home, it sends the clear signal that whatever happens in Kashmir in terms of state repression, imprisonment, disappearances and worse, is unimportant to powers that profess liberty for all. Fazal Hijazi, assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah, and welcome to the Thinking Muslim podcast.
Wa alaikum assalam wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh, Akhi Jalal, jazakumullahu khair al jazak for organizing this much needed discussion about Kashmir, which today goes through a crisis, a very unique crisis, an unforeseen reality which probably the Ummah went through only at the time of independence of India from the British in the 1940s.
So if I may start by asking you about the doctrine, I suppose, that underpins Modi's rise to power, and that is Hindutva. What is Hindutva, and what is its impact on the Muslims in India?
So, Akhi Jalal, jazakumullah khair for this question. And I think this is very relevant in the current scenario that's taking place in India. For many people, the idea of Hindutva remains still ambiguous. And Hindutva is an ideology. And it in principle states that India is the homeland of the Hindus. Now, according to believers of other faiths, they can live in India, but only at the sufferance of Hindus. This is how you can explain what Hindutva is. Obviously, Hindutva emanates from cultural aspirations, but it has over the years had a political impact, and with the BJP in power, which is effectively the political wing of the RSS, the what we can say as the fountainhead of the idea of Hindutva. So they are able to, through BJP, implement a lot of those ideas that they so far only had in theory. And one of those ideas is what we are at the moment hearing very much about in the news, and that is the scraping of the Article 370 and making the annexation or the accession to Kashmir a permanent accession, thereby making Kashmir a part of India officially.
And just for the listeners, who are the RSS?
The RSS is what is known as in Hindi the Rashtriya Swayamvik Sevak Sangh, it's an Indian right-wing Hindu nationalist paramilitary organization. It comes across as a volunteer group, but it is what I would want to mention, and that is what I was saying in answer to the previous question, that they are the parent organization to the ruling party of India, the Bharatiya Janata Party, the BJP.
Now, the BJP are a fairly recent phenomenon in Indian politics, but of course the RSS predates the BJP. Can you give us a little bit about the history of the RSS? When did it come about, and what were its main influences?
The RSS has been in place, or has been there for at least 90 years. It was originally founded in 1925, that is 93 years ago. And their vision is about forming a Hindu nation. They call it a Hindu Rashtra. They believe in upholding the ideals of the Indian culture, and spreading the ideology of Hindutva to strengthen the Hindu community. And a lot of the inspiration they took came from European right-wing groups during the World War II. Initially, they were not that strong, but they played an influential role during the early years, pre-independence and post-independence. So we're talking about the 1940s and later on. Some say that they even had a hand in, or at least they had influence in assassinating Gandhi, and so they've been banned over the past years several times. They've been banned. The last they were banned was in 1992. That was after the demolition of the Babri Masjid, and they had a direct role in demolishing the Babri Masjid. It doesn't really openly come across as a militant paramilitary organization. Comes across as a volunteer organization, that is what has allowed them to spread across the country and build institutions and foundations. And so they've got different sorts of activities that they undertake so as to build connections and win supporters to their cause, led them to build strong influences across the country. Now, a way to be able to and to assess their influence is by assessing the number of shakhas that they run. The shakha is like a morning halakha that takes place. It's a daily morning training that takes place early in the morning, so the assessment there's an assessment that was done that prior to BJP coming into power, they had substantially low number of shakhas taking place. So shakha is basically where people from the community are attending their morning training sessions, which is all sorts of training, including military training. And what has happened is after the BJP came into power, the number of shakhas has gone up significantly. So the last assessment that they did that was in 2016, they mentioned that they had close to 57,000 shakhas happening in the every day in the morning, and that is quite a significant number. That is people who are dedicated to the cause, they're training with them, you know, studying with them, working with them. So this is how you can make an assessment of how influential they are.
And tell me, is Modi a politician who's committed to the ideology of Hindutva and the RSS, or is he an opportunist politician that's playing to the right wing in order to win elections?
So Modi, to be able to understand Modi, you have to go back into his bit about his background. Modi, even though he's a member of the Bharatiya Janata Party, but also is a member of the RSS. I think it would be significant to mention that Modi was actually from early on, from his initial years. Right after he finished schooling, he associated himself to the RSS, and he worked with the RSS for several decades before he went on to becoming a full-time politician. And generally, the system is that people are almost graduated into becoming politicians from the RSS. So those who have the right caliber and have the right competencies are pushed into the political wing of the RSS. So a lot of the members right now in the BJP are direct members of the RSS. In fact, the general secretaries of the BJP all come from the RSS. That is unsaid rule. They are all coming from the RSS. Now, the thing is, Modi very much holds on to the ideas of RSS. And even though he may sound, he may not openly come out with his ideas in public, but his silence on many of the incidents that have taken place clearly show where his inclinations and where his heart lies. And so if you've seen what happened in back in the early 2000s and 2001, the Gujarat carnage that took place, it took place at the hands of Modi, and there were over 2,000 people killed in broad daylight. You find Modi not even making one statement about that. Yes, despite all the attempts to take him to court and the global outrage, and Modi stood by by his position, and there was enough evidence to prove that it was him and the current Home Minister Amit Shah behind all of this. In effect, one of the reasons why he is in power and continues to be beloved by the Hindu nationalists primarily is because of these credentials of his. That is, his credential as someone who is able to subtly give a payback to the Muslims.
So what do you mean by payback?
Remember, one of the ideas that currently is taking place in India, which is and primarily among the Hindus, is that they have a fear. This is what is propagated among them, and that they have a fear that they're made to fear from Muslims, and they're told that the Muslims over the several centuries of their rule have taken away your rights, and this is your time to take back your rights. And this is your country. The Muslims were invaders primarily. They came from the Central Asian countries. And therefore, it's time that you take back from them what rightfully belongs to you. And so they see that Modi is actually showing Muslims their place. And he's doing it subtly. He's doing it quietly. But he's doing it in a way that is leaving a massive impact. And so what is happening is, the nationalists for them, the Hindu nationalists primarily for them, this is the kind of leader they want. They want someone who can actually be able to fulfill their dreams of a Hindu nation while trying to show himself as he's committed to the principles of secularism and by towing the constitutional line. And so for them, when Modi comes into power and he talks about the Babri Masjid, the rebuilding the temple at the location of the Babri Masjid, or removing the Article 370, this is all about payback. This is about showing the Muslims their place. And so what is really their aim, in other words, and that's what I wanted to say in the beginning, their vision is that anyone else other than Hindus should be living under us and under our system, under the Hindu system, under our sufferance, in other words. And this is what they are doing. They're effectively rebuilding or recarving the Muslim identity, and they're making them effectively second-class citizens.
Now, that's very interesting. What form does this marginalization take?
I must say, when we talk about marginalization and making the Muslims as second class citizens, it's not something that started with Modi. You have to appreciate that this has been going on for several decades. It's just that we've tried to remain blindfolded to it, despite the fact that there were enough signs that this was happening. The fact that Muslims are not given jobs in government offices, they're not given ample or equal opportunities for education or business or even in politics. This in itself is a proof that the Muslims over the years have been deliberately, as a part of a system, they have been they have been marginalized. And I must mention, so the Muslims, for example, in government offices, they're not given, it is not easy for a Muslim to get a job in government offices. So very limited Muslims are really taken into the bureaucratic services, despite many Muslims excelling in them. So there are a number of Muslims who excel. But until 2 years ago, if I'm not wrong, the system was set up in a way that gave a lot of arbitrary powers to the examiners to be able to select only those who they wanted. This was through the interview system that they had for the Indian administrative system examinations.
You paint a picture of Muslims marginalized and removed from influence in India, but of course in recent years that marginalization has been more than just in jobs and in, as you said, the public services and education. We've seen a steady growth in mob violence against Muslims.
So I think that is something that was not taking place so far, and that is what I would say is a very new development that has started taking place, which includes mob lynching and mob justice, basically. I must say that this is obviously enough signs to see that this is emanating all the way from the parliament itself. There are enough signs that this is, even though not being said openly, but the very justification is coming from the fact that you have people who are committed militant firebrand Hindutva leaders who have been accused of terrorism and carnage, and they are being given seats in the parliament. That is, they are appointed as members of parliament, and there's not one, two, or three. There's multiple members who are there. There's a few names which are there on my mind, like Sarangi. There is Sadhvi Pragya. These are people who, like Sadhvi Pragya, was just released a couple of weeks before the elections, and she was in prison, if I'm not wrong, for over a decade. And there she is. The moment she comes out of the prison, she is given a ticket to the elections, and she wins with a majority, and with a landslide majority, and she's given a seat there. And so the moment she's there, and she's making all sorts of statements, and you realize that there's absolute silence from the courts, from the party itself. The only voices really are some segments of what they call as civil society, which includes certain newspapers and certain parties. Otherwise, everyone else has been quietened or has been made to shut up. And that is another of those aspects what the BJP has done, that it has almost arrested all sorts of discontent. Most of the leftist writers and leaders have been arrested, or at least have been given have been intimidated into being silent. So I don't find a lot of these people writing anymore, even though a while back when we talk about during the Congress era, they were there and they were writing and they were talking. So what has happened is there is a systematic mechanism they've used to make sure that there is no discontent that appears in public. Going back to the Muslims, when we were talking about the mob violence issue, and so what has happened is that people have realized that we're now in majority, and the system is effectively in our hands.
Can you explain what you mean by the system?
And so when I say the system, I mean the members of the parliament, the members of the legislative assembly, and members of bureaucracy. So remember, the RSS does not just has influence at a political level alone. The RSS has worked for decades, and they have been able to build influence among the bureaucrats as well. A large section of the bureaucrats clearly have right-wing leanings. And we're talking about the bureaucrats within the district administrations, within the police, within the judiciary. And so you find what is happening is that these people on the ground, when they find a certain issue which they think does not go in line with their ideas or their views, for example, if somebody is transporting the cows, for example, they see it absolutely fine that they could possibly arrest this person, harm him, be violent towards him, or even kill him, they know that they would get away with it. This is what effectively happened with a case that took place a couple of months ago in the state of Rajasthan, which was about Pehlu Khan. And Pehlu Khan was arrested, and there was videos, there was a video that was even made about while he was going through that torturous ordeal, and which eventually was fatal for him, and may Allah have mercy on him. And what happened was the six people who were accused, who were there in the video, were acquitted. The court simply refused to accept the video as an evidence. And what is surprising is that this video was not made by a civilian, but it was made by the police themselves. There was a policeman that happened to go through that place at that particular time, and he made that video. And so he did present himself to the courts, but they refused to accept that as a testimony, citing all sorts of excuses. And here they are acquitted, and they're out in the out back in the society. So the thing is, this is and see, remember, this is not just about Muslims doing things which are hurting non-Muslims, due to which they're undertaking these actions. It's not like that. There is absolutely enough unprovoked incidents that are happening. You find two Muslim men going on the street. You find them being questioned, or who you are, and upon if they mention that they are Muslims, you find them being roughed up, being mugged, being beaten up, and some of them even being killed. And we are getting to know daily incidents. The situation right now is that every day, if you open a newspaper, which is covering these kind of incidents, and you'll find that almost on a daily basis you're having these incidents where they are picking up on Muslim men, forcing them to say Jai Shri Ram, which is basically victory to God Ram, and when someone wouldn't say that, there's been enough incidents of them being lynched, of being beaten up. There was this incident of an alim who was going on a train where he was actually pushed down the running train. And alhamdulillah, he's safe. But the thing is that it all happened because of this very aggressive attitude of the Hindu nationalists that is right now taking place in India.
So it seems to me that Modi has taken over the apparatus of state. The institutions have all been eroded, and any concept of a rule of law in any meaningful way now doesn't really exist.
For the moment, that is what is appearing, even though there are laws that are being enacted as we speak. There was a law that was being tabled just today in Rajasthan, which is called the anti-mob lynch law. But the thing is that despite having these laws in place, if the system itself has got its own inclinations of being supportive to the majoritarians or the Hindu nationalists in this case, you wouldn't find much happening due to these laws. It's just effectively the same case with the rape laws that India has. But regardless of the laws, India very much remains the rape capital of the world. Even though there is laws, even though there has been attempts from the judiciary to raise their voice against the spreading intolerance in the country, but very frankly speaking, do you think that these laws are going to have an effect? Well, for the moment, it doesn't seem so. In the long run, if they're able to do something and be able to positively implement the laws, then there may be a deterrent effect as a result of these laws. But really, just having the law, does it really make a difference? No, it doesn't.
Jazakallah khair. You paint a very alarming picture, I suppose, of the Modi government. And now let's turn to Kashmir. You are a regular visitor to Kashmir. You've been there on a number of occasions. Tell us some more about Kashmir, its people, its influences, how you read the current climate Muslim Kashmiris find themselves in.
I have indeed been to Kashmir several times, and I must say, in principle, if you talk about Kashmir itself as a place, then somebody who's based in the West, and if he's been to Switzerland, then this is the Switzerland of the East, effectively. When you talk about the topography of this beautiful place, the Mughal Emperor Jahangir, when he went to Kashmir, he said, اگر فردوس بر روی زمین است همی است و همی است و همی است. There is a heaven on earth. It's here. It's an absolutely beautiful place with beautiful people. If somebody actually visits Kashmir, this is going to be probably the most memorable visit of his life. At least that's been the case for me. And I've been there a few times and met people. I've stayed there over periods of time. I've learned from the people. And the sort of people you have there, absolutely unique kind of hospitality. Unheard of. I've never seen such hospitality in the Arab or among the Ajam. It's a unique kind of hospitality. This is despite all the hardships they go through. Allah has given them this beautiful characteristic that regardless of where the guest is coming from, they are so hospitable towards their guests. So the climate there, in terms of how the people are, in terms of you'll find them very Islamic. You'll find that women and the men, they are segregated. Women are a lot of women practice hijab. Even those who don't practice hijab, they are in modest dressing, which is shalwar kameez and a dupatta. And the best part is, which is very unique when you look at the other states in India, is that every masjid has a maktab. And every student who goes to school generally goes to the maktab before he goes to the school. And so the maktab is where you recite the Quran and you go through tafsir. So they have a Dars al-Quran at the maktab. Most of the masajid, they have Dars al-Quran happening at the maktabs. What is also happening, this is again very unique to Kashmir, and Kashmir being a non-Arab place, yes, this is significant, that you have a lot of institutions that are there where people are learning the deen. And we're talking not just about certain durus that they're attending. We're talking about proper study of the text, of the classical texts. I know of enough such institutions that are doing this amazing work there. They're teaching people the nusus, from the nusus, and you'll be surprised that there are so many Kashmiris now who speak fluent Arabic. They love to read in Arabic, they talk in Arabic, and it's a unique nature of the Kashmiris that they love to study, they love to be educated. You would be surprised that compared to most of the northern states in India, we're talking about at all levels, basically in cities, in towns, and even in villages. You would go to a village and you find these people talking in Urdu. They have multilingual ability. They're talking Urdu, Kashmiri, and English as well. And that is as a result of the educational level there and the amount of efforts they've made towards that. So if you look at Kashmir in general, if you look at how Kashmir is and how the Kashmiri experience is, it is unique, and they call it Kashmiriyat. And the Kashmiri people by nature are very peaceful and they love to live in harmony. I mean, very much contrary to how it is being portrayed. There are a lot of Hindus who live in Kashmir. In fact, the Hindus, the Hindu pandits who live in Kashmir, don't like to leave Kashmir. They love Kashmir. Under no circumstances would they leave Kashmir and go to another, migrate and resettle another place. So, and they call it this as Kashmiriyat. They say this is our culture. This is our hospitality. We love to host people from other religions as well. As long as they come here and live with us in peace and harmony. I think what is pertinent and important at this stage to mention is, what is happening right now in Kashmir, obviously, with the recent scraping of the Article 370. And you want to remember that basically the 370 is a sort of an instrument of accession that was signed by the Hindu leader or the Hindu king of Kashmir. And it was a temporary instrument or a temporary contract taking place between Kashmir and India, which would only be finalized after a referendum referendum that would take place in Kashmir. Now, this is not just unique to Kashmir, because there are at least, if I'm not wrong, there are at least six states in India, which are the eastern states in India, which includes Nagaland and Manipur and Meghalaya. And these states are also, they also acceded to India as a part of a similar article. So the Article 370 was not very unique to Kashmir. And this only proves the fact that the Modi government went ahead and scraped the Article 370 from Kashmir and not from the other other states. It shows the attitude or the mentality that the Modi government has. Because regardless of whether the 370 was in place or not, the central government was effectively still continuing to occupy Kashmir, and they were the ones in power. They were the ones who the police was assigned from the central government. The army was being sent from the central government. You're talking about over 500,000 army being stationed there at all times, and so. What was it really that actually led the government to take this move? Is nothing but impunity and the goal of breaking the Muslims back. They want to break the azam or the resolve of the Muslims, and for the Indian Muslim, remember the Kashmir, within the context of India, the Kashmir Muslim was unique. Why is it unique is because they had been participating in a struggle which had been going on for more than six decades now, which is about seven decades, and they had been consistent and firm, and while they had remained on their aqidah and the deen, and they had only become stronger and stronger when it comes to their deen. And so by doing this, the Indian government really wanted to send a message across to all Muslims that, see, we can break the azam and the resolve of the most, the strongest from among you, and which is the Kashmiris. We will do what nobody else could do. We will do what Sardar Patel wanted to do. And Sardar Patel was the first home minister. He's known as the Iron Man of India. He was responsible for the accession of all the 500 princely states that India comprised of at the time when the British had just departed India, and they say basically this was one work that Sardar Patel had left, and so we are doing what Sardar Patel didn't do, and so in effect they're saying we are uniting India, we are telling the Muslims that. That they need to know their place. They're telling the Muslims that you need to start realizing that this is a Hindu India. This is one step toward moving towards the Hindu Rashtra. Now, how does that happen? Is by further taking this one step beyond, and by removing Article 35, which was a significant a principle or a policy. And this law effectively didn't was the law that didn't allow any non-Kashmiri to buy any property in Kashmir. So this is one of the reasons why the demographics of Kashmir remained almost the same over the 75 years. But now with this happening, with the scraping of 370 and 35A, what happens is that they will now be able to bring in people from elsewhere and be able to change the demographics of Kashmir. This is one of the major fears that people have. So for the Hindu nationalists, this is a major move. For them, in their minds, this is basically the second step. This is the second major blow to the Muslims. The first was when the Modi government was able to interfere with the Islamic law, which is which was related to the talaq, which is another well-known issue which they interfered in and were able to actually enact a law on it by making triple talaq illegal. And the second was the accession of Kashmir. And you're looking at another big major move that is probably going to happen within the next 4 years, within this current tenure of Modi, and that is the building of the Ram Mandir. That is very much a possibility that could take place within the next 4 years. But coming back to Kashmir, this is how the 370 has taken place. The scraping of 370 and its effects have taken place. And I must say that the kind of environment or the atmosphere right now that is developing in Kashmir is absolutely unbearable, very painful.
Now, as you said, Kashmir has been under what we can call martial rule for a great number of years. From your personal experience, how does that play out on the ground?
You know, when I visited Kashmir, I still remember there was this time when we were invited by this brother for dinner, and dinner was right after Isha, and it was about at 8:30 or 9 p.m. And so I was there with my family, and I had a brother who was there with me. His family and my family, we had gone together to the brother's place, and it was a bit late by the time we were returning. It was about 10 p.m. So on the way back to home, and this is all within the city, and we're talking about the capital. We were in the city, and it was dark, and we found suddenly this man come onto the road. He's wearing military overalls, and he's got this torch. He's putting it on our faces. We stop, and the next moment, the next thing we see is the moment we roll down the windows is that we have a massive military gun on our faces, and it was a shock of my life. For me, I had never seen this happening. Somebody put AK-47 on my face, and the moment he saw that there were children with us and our families were with us, he pulled back the gun and he goes like, "Where are you going?" And we said, "See, we're coming back from a dinner party, and we're going back home. So you shouldn't be around here. And why did you not stop the moment I came onto the road?" And we said, "Sorry, we couldn't see. It was dark." And he said, "Make sure you just reach home right now." And so this is when we didn't have this current atmosphere. We're talking about in a reality where everything was normal. This is the daily life that Kashmiris go through. For them, this was absolutely absolutely normal. It's a norm to be stopped by police, to be sent back home from barricades that the police have arbitrarily set up on the pathway. For example, of your work. Yes, maybe you're going to the hospital and you get this. The military has just put an arbitrary barricade there, and you can't go to the hospital. Do whatever you like. Yes, there is no way that you can go to these, you know, wherever you want to go. Basically, this is the kind of environment they have been going through. But right now, while we're talking about this current scenario, which has been taking place for the past 15 days, and I have a lot of people there, and I know some very knowledgeable Elmi brothers as well. And the last they said is, "See, we don't know what's going to happen. They may just shut down everything." And so the reports that are coming in from there currently are not very optimistic. Food is running out. They're not allowing chemist shops, pharmacies to open. They're not allowing grocery shops to open. Most of the places, Eid Salah didn't happen. Wherever Eid Salah happened, that was under military, under the military's, observation, and most importantly, yes, they've stopped Salah in most of the villages. So they've said, "You go and pray home, no Salah in Jama'ah." Can you imagine that's been happening right now for the past almost 2 weeks. Yes, so it's the 11th day since the 370 was actually scraped, and so we're looking at actually is unprecedented. Enough people are being arrested. I mean,
well, have you heard from many of your contacts, your friends who are in Kashmir?
Not getting a lot of information, but whatever is coming is not very pleasing. Every day, young boys are being arrested. I'm also talking about boys as young as 10 and 11 being arrested and then being beaten up. And in big numbers, we're talking about a village. They come, all young boys, just arrest them. They take them, keep them in the barracks for 10 days, and then send them back after beating them blue and black. And this is not something very uncommon, but right now it's happening at a very large scale. I must mention, for example, one of the other issues with Kashmir is how they arrest or control discontent. Yes, they're very ruthless in that. The Indian military and the Indian government, the attitude they have is absolutely inhumane and their barbaric attitude. And so, their special institutions, which are not official, but yet they have a great degree of, they have large powers that exist. Yes, and their only job is to eliminate dissenters and possible militant, militant activists, yes, or militants. The institutions like that exist. And if someone gets arrested by one of those institutions, it is very unlikely that he would come back home. Very rarely do such people come back home. They just go. It's a one-way ticket, and generally they're killed and buried in unmarked graves. This is something very, very common to Kashmir. Kashmir has gone through amazing amounts of hardships. Allah has given them a lot of strength to bear this. Despite that, what we're seeing right now is a few scales, bigger than what has been taking place so far.
And we hear troubling reports that the Indian Army uses rape as a weapon, really, against the Kashmiris.
Absolutely, that is so true. And I must say that on an official basis, they have over tens of thousands of rape incidents that have taken place over the past several decades. And this is just the official numbers. In cases of rapes, the actual numbers are way beyond the those who have come forward. And the killings and the arbitrary arrests and the intimidation. So, for example, I was told by one of these brothers who runs this institute. I wouldn't be able to mention the name of the institute, but they mentioned that they were asked by the police. They were invited by the police, and they were given a warning that they need to stop these halakat that they're doing. And all they were doing was teaching texts. They were studying classical texts. They were studying usul fiqh. They were studying tajweed. They were studying hadith. And they were told that this is your last warning. We are not going to give you another chance. Yes. Either stop this or face our wrath. And we've had enough of these people. Ilmi people, generally, they get arrested, they get beaten up. I know this sheikh who was there, and he's not even an activist like others, but he's a knowledgeable person who has a good say. And he was picked up, and he was picked up by one of those institutions which doesn't has an you know this reality where, for example, if you know the police has arrested you, so you know which police station that they're going to take you to, right? So you would, your family at least, even if you don't have a means to communicate with them, but they would know which police station they're expected to take you to. But that doesn't happen there. There's this institution that just picked him up and took him to wherever they liked, yes. And they kept him in for 10 days, and they beat him blue and black, and just on a suspicion. They believed that he was connected to certain militants. This is why they did this. And it is incidents such as these, I must say, that actually push many of the Kashmiris to further become aggressive and take a further hardline stance against India. Many of the militants of Kashmiri origin, they have had incidents similar to these. They have been either been beaten up or their family members have been killed. Incidents such as these are what trigger their transition into from protests and peaceful protests to violent protests and militancy. This is something that again and again many Indian thinkers have mentioned. But despite that, the Hindu the Hindutva government, the Hindutva Modi government, has actually, despite this this issue, they've gone ahead and decided to further curb all sorts of freedoms, all sorts of rights that people have in Kashmir. And this obviously is not going to play well, because this is very likely not going to have positive, any positive coming out of it. The repercussions are not going to be good. Enough papers are, enough articles are being written about this. A lot of people are going and visiting there and writing about it. There was just a recent article written by a team that visited there, and they said it is people are absolutely angry. The anger is simmering, and they're saying that this is going to be a big fallout out of this. People are saying this is Aryapar. That's what it says is basically there is no more options left. Either it is I wouldn't use a translation my way or the highway, but I would say basically they're saying that this is the last of it. Yes, they are ready to die in their cause, and they will struggle until they die or they become successful. This is what the Kashmiri people are saying.
I thank Fadil for his time today. Jazakallah khair, brother, and may Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala keep you and keep the Muslims in Kashmir safe, and we keep you, of course, in our du'as, and we pray that Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala brings some ease after this hardship. As always, if you wish to contact the show, you can contact us on thinking_Muslim on Twitter. Or you may contact me through my article on Medium. Every week I have a supplementary article which may go into some more depth on the subject, and you can leave a comment below the article. But until next week, assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.